Welcome back to Ecolution. We really hope you're enjoying the new series, and if you haven't already checked it out, why not head to the RTE Kids YouTube to meet our panel and hear what they have to say about lots and lots of the subjects discussed on the podcast so far this season. In the last episode, we talked about disinformation and the difficulty of working out what's true and what's false, particularly in the things we see, hear, and read about the climate crisis. It's a real challenge. Getting your message across about any subject can be quite hard, especially if it's to be spoken out loud to an audience of people. It's even harder if you're trying to make them laugh at the same time. I mean, did you hear the one about the penguin's favourite relative, Antarctica? Yeah, okay, I know it's not great, but can you do better?
What happens when you mix a cow and an earthquake together? A milkshake.
How do young bees get to school? They take the school bus.
What do runners eat before they sprint? Nothing, they fast.
Did you hear that the eyeliner and the mascara got into a fight? Don't worry, they'll make up.
What's a cat's favourite dessert? Chocolate mouse.
Why was the football stadium so cold? Because it was full of fans.
Right, I concede you guys are better. But imagine you did that for a living. Telling jokes to crowds of people night in and night out.
Hey everyone, great to be here. Let's get started. So, two snowmen in a field, one snowman says to the other, "Can you smell carrots?" Carrots? Because their nose is a carrot? Guys?
You stink!
Whew, tough crowd.
Oof, so we agree. Making people laugh is hard. But what if you're trying to make them laugh about the toughest topic of them all?
Hello there, my name's Stuart Goldsmith and I am a comedian based in England. I've been a comedian for about 20 years and now I pretty much only talk on stage in my jokes about the climate crisis.
Wow, quite the challenge. So where would you even start?
Stand-up comedy is all about problems, I think. It's all about talking about your problems, processing your problems, making fun of your problems. And when we're making stand-up comedy, the rule of thumb is that the problems are the material. So if I'm frustrated at one of my kids and I can go on stage and talk about how much my kids are annoying me, then that will give me lots of material. I'll have lots of things to talk about that. I think stand-up comedy really should be about the stuff that you have to say, because if you don't say it, you'll feel like you'll burst. And as a result, because I started noticing there were lots and lots of problems with the climate emergency, I sort of noticed it in newspapers and online over the last 10 years or more. And then I started to worry about it more and more. And I thought, this is a really big problem. And before I knew it, I was talking about it on stage. And of course, to talk about it on stage and try and make people laugh about it, I want to make sure that I'm telling them correct information. I want to make sure I'm not just telling them, hey, everything will be okay, if I'm worried that everything won't be okay. So I'm really curious to all the problems and all the solutions that I can find. And happily, my job gives me the freedom that I can pursue my own line of inquiry. I mean, what a treat, what a privilege to have a job where you can say, oh, whatever I talk about on the night, that's what my job is. So I'm really excited to find out as much as I possibly can about the climate so that I can talk to people about it in a funny way and in a way that hopefully makes them feel better, feel more hopeful, and it makes them want to get engaged with it as well.
I guess, like we've said often, sharing your thoughts and feelings, even day-to-day ones, can really help us to feel better. But what was Stuart's first joke that tried to talk about our climate?
That's a really good question. If I try and think back, what was the first joke about the climate that I had? I've got it written on a piece of paper here. This is, I wrote a list of all the things I tell myself to make myself feel okay about the climate. It was a list of solutions, and they were things like run away, deny everything,
no,
convince yourself we deserve it, fix it yourself, or I can't say that one to children. I think probably the way into it for me was, if comedy's about the problems, the first problem that I identified I had was I sometimes felt scared and hopeless about the climate emergency. And so I would tell myself things to try and make myself feel better. And so I thought, well, that's probably funny, because then you've got a sort of a pathetic, wobbly person flailing around going, maybe if I think about it like this, I can be happy and eat my cornflakes this morning. So I started to talk about that. And really, the bits which connect most with the audience are things that people have already thought themselves, but they haven't necessarily noticed that they've thought them. Take, for example, glitter. My children and I, we always go to the Glastonbury Festival. We go to, you know, toddler raves back when they were toddlers, and everyone would be covered in glitter. And I remember hearing that glitter is actually a microplastic. It is, in fact, a combination of aluminium and a plastic called polyethylene terephthalate. And at this point, if I were on stage, I would say, and that's actually my drag name. So I took the idea of, like, I like putting glitter on my children. I enjoy it when my children put glitter on my face. I don't want to have to stop using glitter. So I found out a bit more about it, and I learned a bit more about microplastics and what glitter actually happens to it. And then that opens up a whole other wider field of problems about the amount of plastics that there are in the sea and in our bodies and all these other kind of scary things. You realise that other people have heard the same things that you've heard, and that other people are worried about the same things that you're worried about. So if you can find a way to talk about glitter in a funny way, then you get to tell people that microplastics are a real issue that they should find out more about, but also you make them laugh because it's something, it's a thought they've already had, and you're phrasing it in a unique and surprising way.
That sounds like an ideal way into communicating things. Observational comedy is about finding relatable things that your audience can see truth in. But what if they aren't as well informed as you'd think?
Hey, you know, when you're contemplating the state of the planet, like you do, and you read about tipping points, and all you can think of is a seesaw. Anyone? No one?
Get off the stage!
When I first started doing stand-up about the climate, I confidently expected that I would say to an audience, hey, you know you're really worried about the climate, right? And they'd all go, yes, brilliant, talk to us about the climate. And instead, the reaction I got was sort of variations on, no, oh, don't talk about that. What climate problems? What are you talking about? This is just me going to a comedy club on a Friday night and trying to be funny about something that can be frightening and sad. We can't imagine that the audience represent the person in the street. But I was surprised to find out that people didn't really seem to want to hear about it. It's a downer, you know, unless you know some very specific strategies and some very specific facts about all the positive, hopeful work, the energetic work that's being done by people to try and fix a lot of the challenges. Unless you know all those things, then it does feel like a real drag. The climate seems frightening and complicated, and to those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, it seems a long way away. So I can't blame the audience for not really wanting to hear about it. And I think part of the job, really, of a climate communicator of any sort is to build a relationship with an audience and get everyone up to speed, get everyone on the same page. So something I say to my audience is, my job is just to bump you all one stage forward from wherever you are. If you're complacent, I'd like you to be concerned. If you're concerned, I'd like you to be alarmed. If you're alarmed, I'd like you to start taking action. And if you're already taking action, then please help me do that, because I struggle with that because I'm quite lazy.
I think lots of us can feel lazy, slow to respond to even small things we can fix.
Can you turn off the lights when you've left the room?
Yeah, I will in a minute.
We can all get our wires crossed, hear something in a person's voice that wasn't intended, and be upset as a result. So what goes wrong when you're trying to talk to people about the climate?
I can only really speak to what I've got wrong. And over the course of the last couple of years, learning to talk about the climate in rooms, on a comedy room on a Friday night when people aren't expecting it, the mistakes that I made tended to be, I let my own fear emanate from me, and that made them scared. I got angry, and that's not a great way to have a conversation. It was only really when I started to find the delight and the silliness and the things that I think are delightful and silly and funny, and I relaxed and I realised that my mission has become to try and get the right joke in front of the right person, and that is the way that I help. I'm unfettered by a lot of the fear that and the hopelessness that I used to carry around, because now I am being really active. So being active, working hard, of course, being inventive, listening to an audience, trying to be sensitive to what they need, trying to notice when your message isn't going across in the way you want it to. I think that's really important. I think that we have to do it with love and hope and optimism. Even if we want to say, help, help, the roof is on fire, we have to find a way to say it that will motivate people to help us putting out that fire. A big challenge I have is when I see people talking about the climate in a way that makes it feel like homework, or it feels like a health and safety briefing, or it feels like a telling off or a dressing down. I think that when you see an effective climate message, if it's in a joke, if it's funny and it's silly and you walk away thinking about it, then that can be really, really powerful. My friend Dave said to me the other day that I had made him think about becoming vegan for the sake of the climate impact. You know, that's a personal choice you can make, along with changing your bank and, you know, all those sorts of things. A very powerful personal impact you can have is to go vegan, or at the very least, just stop eating beef, lamb and prawns. If you quit beef, lamb or prawns, you can burn tyres on your lawn for the rest of your life. You can't and you mustn't do that. Those ones have a huge climate impact. And because I made jokes about them, I made that joke and I made the joke that said, I'm thinking about becoming vegan. I don't want to be. I mean, meat is murder, but I'm kind of fine with that these days. I want to become vegan because it's so inefficient that we use all this land to make that much corn to feed a cow. That's stupid. Just eat the corn. And because I wasn't telling him off and saying, you should be a vegan and I am, and I was going, I'm not a vegan, but you should be, it made him laugh. And he came away and said, well, that's probably the most I've ever thought about actually becoming vegan myself. So being silly and being funny is much better than banging people over the head with your message.
I am fully on board with being silly. We need relief when we feel low, and that could be going to a comedy show, playing with your friends, or listening to your favourite podcast.
Hashtag Egolution forever.
But podcasts are also in the middle of the climate conversation, sometimes to the good, but sometimes to platform climate denial and incorrect information about the state of our planet.
We're just living in this kind of hyper-real time where everything is moving so, so fast. So whenever there is a new thing that is invented, like podcasting or YouTube Shorts or whatever, then all of this kind of creativity is devoted to it, all of this energy and drive goes into it. And that's what humans do. We kind of, you know, we're problem solvers and ideas havers. A new technology exists, and we work out how to do good things with it, and we work out how to do bad things with it, and we work out how to accidentally do bad things whilst trying to do good things. The stage we are at now is that there is absolutely lots of what I would think of as unlicensed opinions. You know, it's not necessarily a good idea to give a million monkeys a million typewriters, let alone a million loudhailers. So the fact that there is kind of unregulated opinion blooming everywhere, driven by an algorithm of outrage. I mean, for example, all of my clips online that do the best, regardless of whether the joke is my best joke or not, the reasons certain of them fly is because people argue in the comments. I've got a joke about baby sign language, and every time I post it, it's a cracking joke, but every time I post it, people will argue in the comments about whether the term baby sign language is infantilizing or insulting to the signing community. I don't believe it is, and I stand by the joke because I went to a class that was called baby sign language. But the fact of the arguments driving the algorithm is astonishing. And what that means, of course, is if I were a particular sort of comedian, or if I were less interested in having integrity, I would think to myself, oh, I just need to say stuff that makes people argue and then I'll be massively successful. And we can all think of examples from comedians and speakers and politicians whereby if you say things that make people angry without caring about the consequences, you can have an enormous social media impact. And as a result, it's like those computer games where you could convert the money into real world money. You know, there are real world consequences to blithely saying stuff that no one's ever going to challenge you on. And even if they do challenge you, great, you get a load more engagement, you make a load more money. Now, my hope is that this time is looked back on as the time when there was just an insane amount of unregulated voices. I'm not hoping for a sort of fascist future where you're not allowed to do podcasts, but I'm hoping for a growth for a sort of an expansion of the critical thinking processes that people have. One of my teachers at school, a history teacher, said, Every time you see a politician in an interview, you must think to yourself, first, before you listen, you must think, now, why is this person lying to me? What's in it for them? And so we have to develop, young people have to develop, and I myself have to further refine the critical thinking that allows you to watch someone saying something to you in a YouTube Shorts clip on their podcast and to think to yourself, what's in it for them? Why would they say that? What's at stake? How do they benefit from espousing that particular opinion? And I think that we will do that in the same way as 10 years ago, my godchildren were at school and suddenly everyone had a mobile phone and there was loads of cyberbullying. And my children now, hopefully, are at a time that comes after that, where we're all aware that cyberbullying is a possibility and we're all aware of the technology. It's no longer as new and we've developed critical faculties based on challenging it.
Last week, we talked about media literacy and knowing how to tell fact from opinion. And I think that's part of what Stuart means. If we can hear a message clearly, for what it is, without baggage, we are in a better place for communication, which is best if you have common ground. But what if you're speaking with people who don't want to hear what you have to say?
Well, there's that phrase, isn't it? Preaching to the choir, meaning the people who are really converted. And it did occur to me a little while ago, people do preach to the converted. People do preach to the choir. If you preach to the choir, they'll feel more happy and excited and comfortable about the things you're preaching about, and they'll sing better, I imagine. So there is definitely a value in preaching to the converted. In terms of wanting to communicate with people who aren't necessarily on board, yes, it is a challenge, and it scares me sometimes because I'm a very privileged kind of a comedian. I'm a straight white guy who lives in Britain, and so I've got so many privileges. The line I would say on stage is, I've got all of these privileges, and if they invent any more, I dare say I shall have them too. So what I have is a bit of a superpower that I can use with mainstream audiences where they just innately trust me. I look nice and I sound nice and people tend to trust me. Not in every environment, but in the kind of mainstream British society, people trust me. So I can use that to, instead of going, hey, everyone, I'm a climate activist and you should be like me, I can say, well, I'm not one of these climate activists, but have you seen what they're up to and why? And I think they've got some pretty good points. So I can try and very gently open the door, not for a conversion, but for a conversation.
Often people don't want to have that conversation because it is scary. I really get it. There are times when all I want to do is have a duvet day, look at silly videos, and just forget all about what's happening in the wider world. The idea that knowing more about the climate crisis is giving yourself more opportunities to be afraid is natural. But what I found is, the more I know, the better informed I am, the better I can handle the bad news, because we find the good news too.
I can say right now with absolute confidence that learning more about the climate crisis has made me feel better. It hasn't made me feel better consistently all of the time. Yesterday, I felt pretty bad. I felt like I'm the holder of forbidden knowledge, secret knowledge. It would be easier, as my mother does, to just stop watching the news and not worry about anything. And, you know, she's earned that, right? She's in her 70s. But I think that although I sometimes feel worried, and I absolutely can feel as scared as the next person, I think that I felt much more scared when I knew less. And now the moments of fear and the occasional moments of hopelessness, that's just part of the territory. I worry about that in the same way as I worry that I too may one day die. I don't entirely believe it, but apparently it happens to everyone. So I worry about that, but it doesn't occupy my every waking moment. And really, being alive is a privilege. Getting old is a privilege, as RuPaul is fond of saying. Aging is a privilege. I think it's a privilege to be alive at the time when the stakes are so high and that our every action and our every attitude makes such a spectacular difference to our future and to our children's future and our children's children's futures. So when I'm down, when I feel bad about it, I try and tell myself why we should feel good. And the down times and the feelings of fear and anxiety don't last so much because there's nothing like helping. If you see a house on fire and it scares you, the best thing you can do is to pick up a bucket of water and chuck it and join in helping. Unless, of course, it's an electrical fire.
Good advice, Stu. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us about his approach to talking about the climate crisis with his own unique comedic voice. If you ever see him on a bill in Ireland or abroad and you're able to get along, snap up a ticket. He is brilliant. While telling jokes might not be everyone's go-to skill set, we all have different talents we bring to the table. You could be actively making a difference in your area by growing plants to help pollinators, cycling to school instead of driving, or simply sharing your thoughts and ideas with friends. Our changing climate is really challenging, and it's natural to worry.
It is frightening, but you mustn't let it ruin your life. People who've been working in sustainability for 30 years will have seen numerous of those governments, people, leaders get in charge, roll everything back, try and destroy the progress that's been made. But nonetheless, we are continuing to head in the right direction. There are an enormous number of people all over the world who are incredibly incentivized, like they stand to get really, really rich if they manage to invent a Hoover that can suck all the carbon out of the sky. And as a result of that, hundreds of thousands of people are working on that technology. It can already be done, but they're trying to work out how to do it at scale. That means they can do it sort of cheaply and sizably enough that it makes a real difference. Money, capital, has decided that the climate crisis is real. So whoever's in charge of America or any other country, if your job as an adult is to work in risk or insurance or anything that's based on working out what's going to happen in the future, you can't pretend anymore that the climate emergency isn't a real thing. And it is all heading in the direction of it's all of us together versus the climate crisis. So don't be scared. Talk about solutions and not problems. There are loads of solutions. We've already invented 90% of the technology that we need to invent to save ourselves. What we need to do is change the narrative and give everyone hope. And you will only give everyone hope by acting hopefully yourself and embedding and embodying that hope inside you so that together we fight it and we win.
Ecolution is produced by Nikki Coughlin and presented by me, Evie Kenny. Please leave a review wherever you get your podcast. It helps.
This is our
RTE Junior Podcast!
For more sort of RTE Kids Podcasts.